Kultur denken, der Podcast des IFK Wien. Liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, willkommen bei Kulturdenken, dem Podcast des IFK Wien. Mein Name ist Martin Gasteiner. In dieser 7. Folge der Staffel Alles bröckelt spreche ich mit dem Kulturhistoriker Omar Nscher. Es geht um verschwundene Begräbnisstätten, um verwitterte Archive und persönliche Verluste. Im Mittelpunkt steht eine neolithische Grabstätte auf Malta, die heute unter einem Rollfeld liegt. Und es geht um das Schreiben als Trauerarbeit zwischen Archäologie, Erinnerung und Poesie. Omar Nscher ist Direktor der Internationalen School for Foundation Studies an der Universität Malta. Er forscht zur Geschlechtergeschichte im Alten Orient und schreibt über queere urbane Geografien im späten 20. Jahrhundert. Aktuell arbeitet er an einer Monographie über Kastration im Neuassyrischen Reich und veröffentlicht literarische Essays auf Maltesisch. Ich wünsche Ihnen und euch viel Vergnügen beim Zuhören.
I explore caves and fissures, rock fissures and caves. A fissure is, it can go anything from like a hairline crack that looks a bit like that.
Very fine. And what do these cracks mean in limestone?
Yeah, so normally what happens is you've got your ground, and because the limestone is really porous, it's like a sponge, right? So the rainwater just percolates through it.
And sucks up the water.
Sucks up all the water. Yeah. And then at some point, it either drains off or it just gets stuck inside the rock. And then obviously, you know, the chemical transformation, acidifier turns into acidic, and it starts to eat away at the rock and forms these caves in the limestone. And every time they're excavating quarries, they find these fissures. And then these fissures can either be empty or they're filled with soil and fossils.
I had no idea it's called fissure.
Yeah, fissure.
So it's rather poetic again.
It's beautiful. Yeah, you've got the prep or a cave, but it's nice to call it a fissure. But this is what quarry workers call it, right? So in Maltese, we have this word, which is darbian. Darbian, that's the Maltese word for it. You know, so the quarry workers call it.
What disciplines are you trained in?
I do a combination of things. So I do a combination of geology, geomorphology, archaeology, anthropology, particularly ethnography.
Okay.
So I combine all of these things.
Disciplines as well?
I'm walking through landscape and I'm walking through disciplines. Sometimes I stay in one discipline where I find that the yield is really good. And then I just walk out of it and go somewhere else.
When do you walk?
I walk at all times of day. I walk at all times of day, but my preferred time is actually midday when it's really hot. It's the quietest time of day in the southern Mediterranean where I am, because the morning is a bit busy car-wise, right? Yeah. So there's a lot of cars, a lot of trucks. Remember that I've been doing my field work in an area where there's a lot of people working in construction.
Yeah, right.
So there's a lot of movement, you know. But if you work around midday, like midday, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, it's really hot. It's intensely hot. But there are very few people around because, I'm sorry. And it changes a lot. It depends on what I want to do. But I'm very basic. I'm really, really basic. So I usually have a notebook, an empty notebook, and I have a pencil.
On paper.
Always on paper. Yeah. I write things on paper and I draw on paper.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have to because I need to make immediate designs and drawings. Normally my notes are like drawings and maybe like a few words from what I hear. And then when I go back, I try to reconstruct things. So this is really important for me. The sort of memory has to play a really important role. Recalling is important, like really important. Because if you just go back home and transcribe everything, then the process of remembering is not activated or it's lessened. I've seen this. I've got some notebooks which are full of almost like transcripts of conversations I've had with people.
So no audio device you have with you?
No, I don't.
So it has to process through your brain?
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah. And through your fingers?
Correct.
While writing? Yes. From the technical standpoint, there's only the technique of writing and listening?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. So talking, not writing immediately. What I do is if there's like directions. So for example, in the early days of the fieldwork, when I needed directions, I would give the notebook to people and they would draw in the notebook. They would make drawings and directions, or they would write words. It's really strange. They say, let me write it down. And they try to write it down. And some people cannot write, so they draw. They're not able to write.
Yeah.
So yeah. It was really important for me to do that. It was really important because I was mostly getting to know people. I went to look for a place, and in my talk, I talk a little bit about this, about how generous people were in trying to help with me finding the place, finding where the ruins were. But then really thinking that I'm actually looking for someone.
Yeah.
What is really interesting is that I went to look for a place, but what I met was a lot of people. It was full of people. It's full of people wanting to talk about the place.
And it wasn't cartographed.
So what we have is some rudimentary reports from 1911, when the site was discovered by this mathematician and a scholar who was investigating these fissures. Some of the workmen in the site, because that's how it normally works. Most of the finds were made by workmen who were either excavating the quarries or building roads, building houses. In 1911, somebody brought him some human teeth.
Okay.
And that's when the fissure was found. And so this is when they realized, they started excavating, they started clearing the fissure of all the debris and all the conglomerate and the matrix that was in it. This is when they discovered that it was a hypogeum, that it was a burial place.
Yeah.
But it was so sensational at the time that they couldn't wait to study it. So they published it immediately because they just wanted to announce it before anybody came along and took credit for it. And because of that, the report was really rudimentary and it was done in a really horrid way.
Yeah.
So archaeology, even at the time, was already being done stratigraphically, but the work wasn't very stratigraphic.
Yeah. And was there any aerographic?
No.
Nothing?
No, we have nothing.
So the first findings, this was the main things, and no cartography as well. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
What we have was then later on in the 1920s, this is when the director of museums was really interested in expropriating the site so that for the government to buy it from the bishop's holdings. So this is when it was mapped out, that plan was lost. And then when I went to the National Archives, in the correspondence, all these plans, there aren't many, there's three of them. I found them in one of the folders of correspondence between the director of museums and the governor at the time. He was trying to obtain permissions to obtain it. He was trying to get the finances.
But it wasn't really forgotten.
It was completely forgotten after the 1920s.
Also in academics. Memorizing it. And
exactly. Then the airport was built in the vicinity, literally 2 meters away from it, is one of the airport runways. And when that was built, this sort of became integrated in that project. Well, so then nobody could really go.
Okay.
And then because it's on the side of one of the airstrips, military barracks, Nissen huts, warehouses, and administrative centers. Yeah. And they also used it, and this is how some of the local people telling me that it was being used for the storage of bombs. There is a painting, which I think could be this place, that shows a quarry, a limestone quarry on the side of the airstrip with bombs stored in it. One of the people in the village told me that they distinctly remember 1950s when a bomb went off and it destroyed what was left of it after the war. So the first hit came in the Second World War, and then the second and last hit came in the 1950s. There was some of it left, some of this Fisher Cave, if we want, left in the 70s. But then when they did the third part of the extension of the runway, that was part of the collateral damage.
Did the bombs destroy more, or did they open something up as well?
No, that's interesting, because what they did was they destroyed everything. They destroyed the entire Fisher Cave. The Fisher Cave was two corridors, about 20 meters long, running parallel with a sort of corridor between them, and all of that was gone. So what we have now, this gaping hole in the ground, covers the entire area of where the caves would have been.
Right.
So then all they did after that was just clear it.
How long was it a burial place?
We don't really have exact dates, but recently somebody in the Natural History Museum in London, a Maltese physician, a pediatrician actually, who's got this big interest in Neolithic human remains, found some of these human remains in the Natural History Museum of London, and he wanted to date them because he is elaborating a theory of an earlier arrival on the islands than the one that is currently being academically proposed. He had them dated, and they date to the late Neolithic, around 2000 BC, 2300 BC. Yeah.
Interesting.
So this was being used at this time. The pottery also confirms that. The pottery typology, when Taliaferro found the site, he found bits of pottery that corresponded to other bits of pottery that were found elsewhere, and so they could secure that dating.
Yeah.
So we would say it's sort of middle to late Neolithic burials. And it wasn't used for a very long time, partly because it's not very big. I mean, it's two corridors of about 20 meters. Well, there, you could quantify how many people were there, about 100 people. So substantially sized community.
Yeah.
A cemetery.
Yes. Mm. I was wondering, after your talk, there were a few really interesting questions, and they all depended on your poetic approach. How do you sense that, and what did you think about it? Because there were ruins as palimpsest. There was collective amnesia, what was always in talk, ruins as practices, and also in current, it is at the beginning, a detective story. Can you tell this detective story in a few lines so that we have a glimpse of it?
Sure. I wasn't aware of this until I actually saw some of the essays in print, right? And one of the editors mentioned this and said, it's beginning to read like a detective story, right? Where we've got this thing that is there, but it's not there, and we're trying to find it, right? So I'm trying to find the site which isn't there in people's memories. In people's memories of other people's memories, because nobody's that old to remember the cave itself properly. So it's memories of other people's memories. And then I'm obviously going into every nook and cranny of every single museum and archival institution, trying to look for photographs, trying to look for material remains, trying to look for correspondence, trying to look for textual documentation of the site. So yes, it is beginning to read a little bit like a detective story.
Yes.
I believe that some of the site is still there in total ruins under the current existing structures.
So it's really a palimpsest of graves in this kind?
It's a palimpsest of graves. It's also a palimpsest of different periods.
Yeah, and memory. And you are fascinated with this site. And how long are you working on it?
Right, so I have now been working for 3.5 years. So I know the place really well. I know a lot of the people really well. And now I feel that I have this responsibility to pay tribute to two people in particular who are, for me, closely related with the site. Let's go perhaps back to this idea of a comment that was made on the sort of archaeopoetic approach and where this came from. So originally, I wrote some of my work in English, but the editors of a Maltese literary journal called Afro Confuso, Laurent Vella and Joe Gutt, and I discussed the possibility of writing about Burmese in Maltese. I hadn't thought of that, of course, because I thought of it as an academic piece of work.
Yeah.
Right? So I hadn't thought of putting that, the work I had been doing in Maltese, in a literary journal. It never occurred to me. And what I had was a technical piece about archaeology and archive and the material remains. Yeah. I had an inventory, et cetera, et cetera. And when I sat down, Joe, Loran, and I went for a walk to the site. We toured the site really well. We took photographs, some of which I used today. And I decided to try to write about it in Maltese, which is something I had not done before. Even though it's my native language, I had never written in Maltese. When I started doing that, it became something else. It became a series of literary essays, of which there are five. Three of them have been published. The fourth one will be published in a few days. And then the fifth and final one in a while. And so when I started writing that, I started to connect things. When I was writing in Maltese, which is my maternal language, I realized that actually I was writing about my mother. When I started the fieldwork, that is when my mother's health started deteriorating. My mother had been sick for a long time, for about 10 years at this point. She'd been diagnosed with cancer about 10 years before. She was well, she lived a really good life, but I was constantly waiting for that moment to happen, right? And so when I realized that the moment was approaching, it's very strange, but I went to look for a grave. Yeah, so as soon as I made this connection, when I was writing, after my mother passed away and after I buried my mother in our family grave, which is a limestone grave, as I was writing, I started to make this connection that this was my way of visiting the pain and also thinking about what we're going to do, thinking about how I'm going to manage her body after death, the death rituals and the grief and the funeral rituals. It all sort of came to me as I was writing, and I decided to write about this.
In your mother tongue.
I decided to write about it in my mother tongue. I decided to write about my mother.
Yeah.
So I write about my mother. I write about the actual last days, the care of the body, the burial of the body, the materials we use, the site we use, the rituals we use, while I am writing this technical scientific report on a lost site, right? So I keep coming and going between narratives. And at the same time, I include as well these narratives of people who worked for a really long time with limestone and who are looking at the properties of limestone, things which I never knew before, even though I used to play with limestone when I was a child. My toys were made out of limestone because it's very plastiform. You can you design it in ways that you want. My grandfather used to do it. My grandmother used to do it. It's in the family. We used to get bits of limestone and my grandfather would carve things and give them to me, and I learned how to do that myself.
So your personal history was in a form materialized through the limestone?
Through the limestone.
And also your memory.
Correct.
And gives you your connection to your people and to your, to Malt.
I keep talking about my people, like my family. Okay. I keep talking about in writing, you know. I use the word Nisi, you know, so they are my people, my family, my people, right? And I keep talking about the grave as, you know, our common home and where we belong together. So this is really interesting. I see this as my mother's most lasting financial investment. She bought a house for all of us.
We will be together again.
Correct.
Like this.
Yeah. This idea of the communality, right? Correct. Which is what we were seeing in places like Burmese, in that burial, where we have more than one generation being buried collectively, right? So you can see that as some sort of collective burial. When I was doing this, I also wanted to tell the story of who I believe to be the last guardian of the site. So it's this guy known by the sobriquet Ilmiya, which means number 100, the 100, right? And Ilmiya was at first, you know, he wouldn't interact with me at all. So I would be there taking photographs, you know, and things like that. And you could tell he looked deeply suspicious. Also because sometimes I walk with my dog, right? He didn't like my dog very much, I have to say. But then once I went without the dog and he opened the door and he welcomed me to his little garden patch. It's half the size of this cave here. And it overlooks the quarry. It overlooks the pit.
Yeah.
Right? And he's got this little garden with an almond tree and an olive tree and some water tanks that collect rainwater. And he's got two or three bee boxes. And that's his little sort of utopia. So that's his little rudimentary experiment in sustainable agriculture. And he welcomed me and he told me not to take photographs and he told me not to put anything on Facebook. And I told him that was not my intention. I said, you know, I know I've been reading that there was a Neolithic grave somewhere around here. I know he knew that it was there, but he wouldn't tell me. Yeah. But one really interesting thing about that is that he was so willing to describe what the landscape looked like when he was a child and how before the airport was there, they would walk from the side of Burmese across what is now the runway to the other side of the valley, to this place called Idebdeba, which is the echoing place, the place of the echo. And he describes Idebdeba as Art Jebeda, so land which is really good for bird hunting, right? So he was a hunter and he would go and hunt birds over there. I got to know him really well. We would spend a lot of time together. And he used to make whistles. He would take bamboo sticks. Yeah. He would take anything, really, broomsticks, billiard sticks, bamboo, and make bird whistles for plover.
Right.
But the most fascinating thing is he used to take small pieces of limestone and carve them into whistles as well. He would drill a little hole in the middle and he would insert it into his mouth and he would blow in and this bird sound would come out. But what is really interesting is that recently, very recently, I went to speak to him. I think it was around November I went to speak to him and I looked inside the garden patch and I realized that he hadn't watered the trees in a while, that everything looked really sad.
He was gone?
Yeah, yeah. And so when I went to the village square, the owner of the band club bar, I ordered a coffee. He gave me a coffee and he also gave me a picture of the guy. And he said, you know, he's passed away, right? And it was really sad. The village elders, the older men in the village, were talking to me. And one of them said, oh, there's something you don't know about him. And I'm sure they said, but I don't know about him. And they said, well, he, you know, once he found a bone in his garden, and he turned that into a whistle and he won a competition with it.
Okay.
And the writing, in a sense, pays homage to the past and to ruins, but it also pays homage to my mother and to the fact that she actually bought a grave for us. It also pays homage to the last guardian keeper of the site who has just now passed away. So I think this is why there is the sense.
I was wondering if it is your duty to be the guardian of the site in a kind of sense. Yeah.
Yes, I think now it is the duty of the community. So I'm looking forward to sharing my writing with the community, to sharing what I've done, the project with the community, to open it up to the community so that the community can take it on, right? And keep it as an open site rather than a closed archaeological tourist attraction.
Can anybody read these essays?
Yes. They're also written in a way that is readable. I also have audio version of them. People listen to them in their car on the way home, and so I try to share the audio.
But how many languages do you speak?
Well, I grew up with Maltese and English and Italian. Those are the languages I used almost on a daily basis, because it's what people in my generation did at home. So I would go to school and everything was in English, and then I would go home and everything was in Maltese, or most things were in Maltese, depending on the relatives I was spending time with.
Yeah.
So my grandparents, it would definitely be in Maltese. My mother, it would be both languages, both Maltese and English, depending on who was at home.
Yeah.
If it was Maltese people at home, we spoke Maltese. If we had friends at home, we'd speak Maltese and English or exclusively English. And then in my entertainment moment, I would watch television in Italian. I went to study in Italy when I was 18, to Milan. Yeah, I went to Milan. But my Italian was good, but it wasn't that good. But it was good. I could understand everything already. Just not from formal lessons, but from
From watching telly.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then I studied different languages academically. So in terms of the languages that I speak, I sort of code switch between Maltese, English, and Italian.
But Maltese, is what kind of influences does it have? It must be a Mediterranean thing.
It's the same language family as Arabic, as Hebrew. Very similar in a lot of cases. Very similar to Arabic. Structurally, almost identical. Yeah. Not in writing. Not we write Maltese in Latin script from left to right. Yeah. It's in Latin, Roman characters, yeah. There was an attempt early in the 20th century to write it in Arabic script, okay. but it wasn't taken up. And yeah, I would say that most of the high frequency occurring words in Maldives are probably, they sound Arabic, they're Semitic, they're very similar to Arabic. So anybody who speaks Arabic and who comes to live in Malta usually learns to speak Maldives in about 2 months. Really? A month, 2 months. Yeah, it's really easy. And very convincingly as well. In most cases, it's really hard to tell whether they're Maltese or not Maltese. So that's how similar they are. It depends on your background. It depends on your level of education. So sometimes, for example, we have two words for the same thing. So for example, the word airport, you could use a more sort of Latinate European word, which is aeroport, and that you would recognize. Yeah. Or you could use the Semitic word, which is mityar. Was the same for a lot of things. And then your choice of whether to use a Latinate, sort of more continental, more European Maltese over the more Semitic Maltese was okay with its political ramification. You revealed yourself politically.
Yeah.
If you chose Semitic, you were aligning yourself with the socialist left, right?
Really?
Yeah. And if you used the more sort of continental Latinate yeah. Maltese, you were more conservative, right?
And if you're going to British or English? What kind
of that positioned you on the sort of center to right position, more conservative okay. position. And it aligned you with a particular political party in yeah. Malta, the Nationalist Party, the Conservatives, and the Christian Democrats. Whereas if you spoke Maltese all the time, right, then that aligned you more oh. with the left, with the socialist left. And this is really interesting. Look at the party newspapers, look at political newspapers, right? Quantify the number of times that the conservative paper uses European Maltese words and the number of times
yeah.
the socialist party paper, Semitic words for the same thing, right? And, you know, this would come across really clearly. So that, I think, is really interesting. Now there's a bit of a shift, right? Now the traditional sort of center-left is more sort of socially ambitious. And so a lot of those people speak to their kids in English, even though their use of English is not that good. So this is really interesting because in a sense, there was a whole generation, like my parents' generation, who were very entangled mm-hmm. in this idea of mimicry of the colonizer, right? So if you didn't yeah. do things like a proper English person, then you were not doing things right. If you didn't speak properly in English, you weren't doing things right. Yeah. At one point, like speaking English correctly with a good accent was synonymous with being educated. So there's this whole idea of mimicry. And if you didn't do it, you know, that automatically signaled that you were not smart enough, accomplished enough, well, you know, and things like that. Now I think we're seeing something a bit different, because now I think we're seeing mimicry of those people who mimicked the English,
yeah.
right? So we're seeing mimicry of that class, right? Of the Maltese colonizers who live like expats in Malta, right? And they talk about Malta as though they are not part of it.
Yeah.
They generally refer to Maltese people as the Maltese, right? In the third person plural. Yeah. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. But when I was 14, I had the opportunity to improve my English. And the one way was going to Britain, and the other one was going to Malta. I broke my hand and I didn't go to Malta. And I always thought, well,
the summer in Malta,
I missed
right?
something,
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to swim.
Of course.
And Britain then was pretty cold. Yeah. Now it's getting warmer, I think.
Yeah. That's why
but language was, you have to go to Malta. Nothing in Europe, no other place. Britain or not.
Language teaching industry is still very strong, still very big.
Daniel told me he was a teacher as well.
I think that's how we met, actually. We met at language school years ago.
Interesting.
Many, many years ago. Okay. That's how you survive as a student, right? So what you do is correct.
Well, shifting into poetic things like your essays.
Daniel and I are sort of moving in parallel ways. I find myself at this stage where even in my academic writing, I am less concerned with footnotes, for example, young writers, emergent voices and things like that.
So what,
I think every writer should show that you've actually done the reading. Yeah.
And your own character as well, and your story. Correct. But what did you think about Leonard's presentations down there? His form of articulation and ironic moments, having the beer kicked and how he approached the game. Yeah. I thought, well, why aren't we articulating ourselves other ways?
Correct.
Why?
Yeah. I had this conversation after my presentation. I had a conversation with Leonard about that because he said, thank you. I really enjoyed that, particularly the way you deliver things. It's like you're reading poetry. It's like you're talking to someone, which it leaves a little bit the usual standard academic paper delivery. I said the same thing about his. I said, well, yours was as much of a performance. I experienced that as academic theater, right? Which is what I loved so much about it.
Everything will rise.
His body movement, you know, the rhythm, the tempo at which he delivered things, the pauses, right? I think it was definitely academic theater, and I absolutely loved it. And it's good to see that. I find it really difficult to follow papers that are delivered in monotone, really fast, or just reading without the sense of audience, without the sense of I'm conveying a message to an audience. And often we find also this arrogance of a lot of people who think that their audience has done the same reading, like this idea of referring to obscure academic theories, academic tests. There's the assumption that you know all of this, right?
Yeah.
Right. And so to assume that your audience have done the same reading or are completely familiar with something that you can just give to them in 1 minute and are able to process that after 7 presentations and 700 coffees, I find that really challenging of reinventing the form itself. Both the academic paper and the delivery of that, which I think are both really important because this is how we communicate our work, right?
But when we did have the iconic turn and so on, everybody was speaking about this and nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
This was 20 years ago. So what is happening with these disciplines? Are they not evolving anymore? Is there less power in them?
I find that happening so infrequently, partly because my colleagues, my friends, people in my network are so concerned with publications and promotions. They're not willing to experiment, to put themselves out there and say, I'm going to try a new form. Also because you go through so much training to get to that point. And that's when you have to let go of the form.
You have to experiment. And where can you do this?
And you don't always have the invitation. I'm really lucky to have had the invitation that Lauren and Joe from Afro Confuso came and they said, you know, we would like to invite you to write here. So I think there needs to be perhaps more editors of literary journals who reach out to academics and say, you know, would you like to write about your work?
Yeah.
Using narrative if you want, using storytelling if you want. And I believe that a lot of people would be really happy to do that.
And could listen to this as well. So more of an audience then.
I believe there's a lot more poets in academia than we know. Right. Yeah. Because there are contractual conditions and promotion conditions and salary conditions that we have to meet. The writing takes time. The writing really takes time. And then when you submit your draft, the editors do the work and then you have the meetings with the editors. At Afro Confuso, the work is really long, drawn out. It's a lot of communication, a lot of discussions going on.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And they're very good readers. That's really important. You know, the editors are really good readers. They check, they come back to you, they ask you questions, they make you think things again. So you sort of feel safe because that's the ecosystem that we need when we're producing work. We need editors that we trust. There's so much at stake. You could literally destroy all the work that you've done to do the work properly and who say, listen, this is good, but this is not.
Omar, this was a pleasure talking to you. Do you have the time?
And then I'll go and have my coffee.
But it's real. Time is flying.
Wow.
So Leonard thought we are 10 minutes gone. I said to him, no, this was quite an hour.
Right.
So it's pretty fast, but very fascinating to talk to you.
The questions are very good as well.
So may I ask you about this last question? What are you taking with you out of this conference?
Mm-hmm.
The multi-generational, the multidisciplinary, but also the focus on ruins and how and where we stand today.
Yeah.
posing or in distance and always looking, well, the South is going to be these ruins. We still are, well, quite well, and we won't face any catastrophes in this. So we can always say, it's there, but it's never here.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yes, I apart from the human contact, which was great, getting to know people, getting to know what other people are doing that really resonates with me. So, for example, emptiness is really important for me. Yeah. Remember, I come from a place where there is this increasing rhetoric of scarcity and, you know, we have no space. We keep talking about how construction is devouring and colonizing everywhere. We have no more pristine space left, right? And then at the same time, parallel rhetoric of, but there are so many places that are still empty, right? So we have these two discourses that are entangled in our daily lives. The idea that there is no more space, and the idea with there is so much empty space, right? So much empty room. So during the presentation, I was really thinking about the work that I have done with empty spaces. I've looked a lot into queer social histories and queer sexual histories and how ruins are the places that give affordance for gay cruising, for example, and gay sex in public spaces, and how they get reutilized as public boudoirs, right? So I think that it's really interesting how both these ruins as well as public gardens are used for that. I thought a lot about how growing up in the village, we used to go to these ruins to find fridges thrown away and pull out the magnets. And then, because a magnet was something you couldn't buy when I was a child, right? It's like, where'd you go to buy a magnet? You know, someone gave you a magnet, but you didn't go and buy it, right? And so we'd go and pull out like fridge door rubber and take out the magnets. But I remember at one point we could no longer go because they were being used by some people in the village for sex work. They would wait in the ruins. The ruins are sort of there and not there. They're these ambiguous spaces because they're in the village, but not really in the village.
Yeah.
But in the village enough for us to go and play, but not in the village enough. And so at one point we were told not to go there anymore, but no definite reason was given, right? And then a few years later, I was told, this is why you were stopped from going. So I think I really came back to ruins because 3.5 years of thinking about ruins in a particular way, I came here in 3 days to change or rethink certain things. One other thing that I've been thinking about, I thought a lot more about over the past 3 days, is how we have a very particular way of engaging with ruins in Malta because we still associate ruins in a positive or a negative way with the colony. So some people look at ruins and there is this sense of nostalgia for when the British were there and we had order and, you know, the buildings were nice and the buildings were lovely and how we wish the British were still here. We wouldn't have this, right? And on the other hand, you have other people who experience ruins, who equate ruins with the colonizer because they see the invasion of vegetal life, for example, and they refer to it in exactly the same way as they do, you know, to the British, like, oh, you know, it's taking over everywhere. These ruins are taking over everywhere. They're colonizing everywhere, right? And I hadn't thought about that. I did not think how much, the extent to which they're actually a part of the social fabric, and they're really a big part of the social fabric.
Yeah.
There is very little alterity in the ruins with which we live. Oh, they're still very much part of our social fabric, our political fabric, the fabric of our imaginary, right? It's still very much there. I don't think they are out there. I think they're still very much inside.
Die Signation unseres Podcasts stammt von Sebastian Klingowski. Wissenschaftliche Beratung erfahren wir durch Karin Harasser, Andreas Gerlach und Julia Burg-Kaminski. Für die Öffentlichkeitsarbeit zuständig ist Stefanie Obermeier. Technische Unterstützung Max Ott. In der Produktion unterstützen mich Christina Högler, Daniela Losinitzky und Andreas Katan. Die Konzeption des Kulturdenken-Podcasts stammt von Alexander Martor und mir, Martin Gasterner. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Wir freuen uns auf ein Wiederhören in der nächsten Folge von Kultur Denken.